Hello, ladies, and welcome to November. I hope you're all doing very, very well this beautiful fall day. I decided to do a little bit different this month. As you know, I am changing things here at my Warrior Woman programming, and we are putting more of a focus on the internal, on the personal growth side of things, which I've always promoted, but has kind of been lost in the whole, I need a workout. I need some more exercises. I want to get rid of the 20 pounds, or I want to, you know, tighten and tone, which is all great, great stuff. It always is. But what I've learned, and I've been on this path for four decades now, is that there is such a need to go into the inner world, into the inner aspects, and be able to coach women from a different place, from a deeper place, from a more all-encompassing place, because that's where true change happens. I always say health and wellness is an inside job. So is healthy relationships, your ability to make money, where you are in your world and in your level of happiness and wholeness and well-being. All of that is because we are multidimensional beings. So while I'm kind of known as the fitness girl, we're going more into all things encompassing what being a person, a woman, a human being living on this earth is all about. And I know that many of you have been on your own journey, as I have been. As you know, I'm pretty open about my journey, the good and bad, the good, bad, and ugly. And we're all in process. We're all looking for the joy and the sunlight, and we all want to just feel so invigorated and awakened in our life, and that potential is there. But what happens is it just gets crusted over. And I've had many years of working with some amazing teachers, but truly the one element that you all need to bring forward into this work is a willingness. It's a willingness and being ready. Even if you're scared, even if you're fearful, even if you don't understand how it's going to work, that's okay. It's just a willingness to say, okay, let's step in. Let's see, like I say, what would courage do now? If I just had to show up today, if I just had to stop what I'm doing, slow down long enough, look at my life, look at where I am, and just say, all right, let's take stock here. Let's take a look and say, where do I really want to go? What is it that's missing? What do I want to add on? Where do I feel inspired? Where do I feel excited? Where do I want the next half of my life to look like? Really, what do you want the next half of your life to look like? Because we're all halfway there or over it, right? So no more waiting to be discovered. No more waiting for something to change. No more waiting for somebody to change, and then we'll change. It's not out there. It all starts within. And so that's been a lifelong lesson of mine, of course. And we'll go through that, because I have a couple of archetypes that I want to go through with you, too, that I see that are common in women who are searching, who are on the path, but just a little bit off track, where they're just not quite sure how to get back on. So I thought, you know, Remembrance Day coming up, I thought this would be a very appropriate lesson to bring forward, because it is about remembering who you are, right? And we all saw that in The Lion King, where the little Lion King goes off and Mufasa speaks to him, his father from the heavens, saying, who are you? Remember who you are. You've strayed. And he, you know, had all this responsibility of leading the tribe and doing big stuff, leading everybody to the promised land. And then he just got overwhelmed and scared, and then he became a little rebel and hung out with a monkey and all that kind of stuff. And there was always a nagging inside him that said, you know, I don't think this is where I'm supposed to be. I think I'm supposed to be out there. I think I'm supposed to go into something else. And he did know, but he just was denying. So when we look at the word denial, we always say, what does denial stand for? Didn't even know I am lost. D-E-N-I-A-L. Didn't even know I am lost. And I do find that this is pretty prevalent in a lot of people these days, especially as life has sped up. the generations are certainly different than they were before. The big changes from our generation to the millennials is huge. There is this disconnect, not necessarily in a bad way, but there's such a change. And it's causing a lot of chaos and confusion, a lot of, you know, people hanging on to the old way, people trying to bring in the new way. They're trying to get their new identity, but they just can't quite get there. We've got the muddling of social media and these unrealistic expectations that a lot of our youth are challenged with, and it's just a very trying time for everybody. I don't know about you, but when I'm driving my car, when I'm in a shopping mall, I see more irate people. We're seeing more road rage. More people are losing their top. We're all pushed to the limit faster and quicker now. There's something going on here, and we have lost touch with ourselves. It is not about our politics. It's not about our unions. It's not about the money. It's not about our education. It's not about what our roles are, who we are. It really is about us as a being, as a person in this world. And we have to draw it all back to the simplicity of I. Come back to I. But, you know, it's really interesting because people are afraid of it or they don't know how to do it. And it's so simple. You know, I saw this thing on Facebook the other day, and it was a post, and it said, all right, name the top 10 things that you love. Right? And then it said, I bet in one of those top 10 you never said loving yourself. And I thought, whoa, that's pretty profound. That's pretty profound. So in this little lecture series, two-part series, I'm going to, there's also a handout that's going to summarize everything with this audio embedded in it as well. And I'm going to go through a couple of milestone moments in how we got to where we are. And then in the second audio, I'm going to go into some pretty interesting archetypes. Archetypes are just a symbology. They're a shortcut to define certain aspects that create this persona. And I know some of you who took my freebie four-week course were looking at this, and we're going to be going into this in more depth in the Empowered Living course that starts on November 11th. Actually, I think I'm going to move it to doing Tuesday nights instead of Monday nights because I already have my Monday night class. So that's the Empowered Living with Karen course that's coming up, and I think I've got 9 of you that are in that right now. So we're still taking, obviously, still taking sign into that. So let's start with remember who you are. Here's a story, and I know you guys have heard this one from me before. In 1954, the Buddhists were being invaded, and of course, all the monks had their earthly gold. And they had beautiful gold statues, minis of mini Buddhas, and they were solid gold, and they didn't want the army to find them. So what they did was they just encrusted them in layer upon layer upon layer of clay, and it just became a big blob of clay. And so that was the only way they could hide their treasures from the invading army. Fast forward however many years, and they're dragging these, this is from the Burmese army they were hiding from, they were dragging these big clay things out of the caves, and one of them, and with big heavy ropes, and they were thousands and thousands of pounds, one of them, the platform broke, and the ropes pulled it down to the ground, and it split open, and within these clay statues were these little gold Buddhas, pure, solid gold. And so it's a lovely metaphor to say, over the years, what we do as we're trying to meander our way through this journey called life, trying to find our path, trying to do the right thing, trying to excel in our life and our work and our families, we tend to put layers upon us. And it's, for the most part, it's unconscious. Now, I've gone through a lot of this work over the years, and I'm revisiting it again. I do remember moments in my life where it was conscious, and I know that the more you do this kind of journeying, the more you do this kind of work, I hate to use the word work because people are like, oh, it sounds like duty. I don't want any more work. I don't mean it in that way. I got to find another word for the word work because people are like, oh, I'm so overworked as it is. This journey of self-discovery is a joy, but it does require diligence and courage and a sense of curiosity. And if you're curious and open, those I find are the two best traits that we can have to embark on this journey of awakening, so to speak. I always say the most interesting people to me are the people that are curious and open, and the most uninteresting me are the people who think they know it all or they close it off or they just don't care to really consider or look any deeper. I just find them so boring. Right? I was one of them for a lot of years. I know how flat and one-dimensional it was. And, you know, I taught my son when he was very young. I kind of saw the world and the people in it as being either one, two, or three-dimensional. And one-dimensional were people that, you know, kind of knew it all. They're on the straight and narrow and everything is what you see is what you get. They were really based in the five senses. And the two-dimensional were people that were a little bit more risky. They weren't as rooted in their beliefs or their convictions or their opinions. When people have strong opinions, they like to pride themselves. I have very strong opinions, and I'm like, oh, okay. In other words, you're so scared you don't want to consider another point of view. I have to say that to my ex-husband all the time. You have strong opinions. Okay, that's just your way of saying you just – you know, it's control. It's all control, right? Safe. It's about safety, and safety is about maintaining control. And what we do know, and I know a few of my one-on-one people are listening to this, I talk about this a lot, there is no control. And when you actually learn to hand over control and you surrender, that is the best lesson ever. But it takes time. You can't think your way to it. You actually have to feel your way to it. And that's, again, what our Western culture does not want to deal with. Tell me what book to read. Tell me what class to take. Tell me what teacher to listen to. No, you have to do the feeling work. So anyways, I lost my train of thought. Oh, yeah, the Golden Buddha. So here we are. We've got this lovely layering that's happened over us. And when we start delayering, we start chipping away at that hard clay, then we can get to what really matters. And I remember when I when my son was first diagnosed, of course, that was in 2001, and my world fell apart because it was probably the worst diagnosis that you could ever get. And, you know, living with a terminal degenerative illness that was going to rob him every day of more and more strength and more life. And I was beside myself. Of course, I had a really hard time coming to terms with it. And what I recognized was that in that time, I had to continue to surrender to the universe, surrender to what was happening. And this is where I came up with my arms wide open mantra that I use a lot. Instead of closing down and trying to control, I have to fling my arms open. And I physically do it a lot. Open my body up because the body is reflective of our thoughts, beliefs, patterns, and conditioning. So when we're tight, when we're always crossing our arms, when we stay armored in ourselves, and this is what anxiety is. I know that one well. Anxiety is a diversion, and anxiety makes you armor yourself against what is, but that is just fear. So when you look at the FEAR acronym, you know, false evidence appearing real. I don't like that one, actually, because there are some real things that make you scared. Like, I'm freaking terrified of flying, okay? It's not false. It's real. I don't like it. I don't like the stats. I don't like it. I like to use the acronym for fear of face everything and rise. So that means just going in when you don't want to go in. And there was a book when I first started this journey 30 years ago called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. And it was by Jerry Lambolsky, I think. And the other one, of course, I read was Melody Beattie's Codependent No More. And these are books that have been around for 30 years. But Feel the Fear and Do It Anyways means you can't get rid of fear by not doing it. You learn to do by doing, just like a bicep curl. You can't learn it by reading about it. You can't learn, you can't grow muscle by watching a video. You've got to move into it, right? So face the fear. And so for me, it was always about going into the fear. And this is the thing, because we often want to think our way out of stuff, or we don't want to feel the fear. And honestly, grief and fear and anger are the three biggies that women have a really hard time. And of course, all people, but of course, my teaching is all towards women. And I get it. But here's what I say to my one-on-one clients. The more you go in there, the easier it gets every time. And so what happens is, in time, you can learn to live an awakened, empowered life where you just go, click your fingers and go, I got to go back in. I got to go back in. I got to go into the swamp, dig around a bit, and this time I'm going to get out fast. Because the first few times, you don't know what you're doing. You don't know the swim strokes. You don't know what the swamp is all about. You don't know what creatures are in there. But eventually, you become familiar with it. And it becomes not uncomfortable in the way that it's just disabling. It's like, well, I don't really want to go into the swamp, but I know now nothing's going to hurt me in there. Nothing's going to pull me down. I'm not going to drown. There's no evil things in there. So this is what this work is all about. And you guys know this if you ever stammered about going back to school, how scared you were going, you know, heading back into college or university, going into a new job, right? You had the security of the old job. Now you got to go into the new job. And this fear is normal. It means that you're pressing up against something that needs to change. And the thing is, we can press through as adults in so many ways in our lives. As we move into parenthood, as we move into home ownership, as we move up the financial and career ladder. But we're so afraid to move in when it has to do with ourselves, with our own thoughts, with our own beliefs, with wanting to grow into our lives and grow into our light and our goodness and our joy. And we're like, oh, but it's going to hurt. It's not. Feelings can't hurt you. It's your thoughts around the feelings that are holding you back. So this is where we go into this work, and it becomes very empowering and very simple. And it just comes faster and faster. And so when we come back to the story of the Golden Buddha, every one of us has this lovely, joyous, beautiful longing to reacquaint ourselves with the gold within. And it's always there. We have just layered it over with life, with fears and expectations and failures that we chalk up to, oh, well, I guess that just wasn't for me, or to, you know, what other people are doing and being in competition and having the best car and the best house or whatever it happens to be. And so we dim our light, just like the clay Buddha. It's covered from the light, and every layer that goes on takes you further away from the sun. That's what we do in life, and we just don't even notice it. Didn't even notice it. Denial. Didn't even know I am lost. Until you get to be 40 or 50 and you go, oh, that's just life. Oh, well, you know, that's aging. No, it's not, actually. We're supposed to maintain that genuine awe and spark that we had. And I know you guys have experienced some of that. If you go on holiday, if you break your routine, if you win the lottery, whatever it happens to be, that spark is always there. We just need to reignite it. And so I've recognized that because I spent many years in the dark, and they were confusing and tiring and heavy. Very, very heavy. And in doing this work in the last few years, what I've recognized is I've lost a lot of time. I've lost a lot of time thinking, you know, it's going to get better. Something's going to change. Or the next, you know, shopping spree at the mall is going to make me feel better. Or when I get a better body, I'm going to be better. Or whatever it happens to be. It doesn't work that way. I want you guys to wake up every day and be happy the moment you wake up, regardless what's happening in your life. Your life does not dictate your happiness. And this is where so many people in the Western culture are just out to lunch. And me included, yours truly included, for a long, long time. Now I wake up and it's like, can I be happy? Sure. Well, I still have a sick kid. I still have an achy body. I still have a body that's breaking down. I still have a mortgage. I still have bills. So I can't put that all on a list and then define if I'm happy. It's not supposed to work that way. But that's the way we work it, right? And it's crazy. So I want to talk about a couple of things. So I've got 1, 2, 3, 4 things I'm going to talk about on this audio. And then I'm going to go into the second half on another audio. First of all, how the brain works. We are a bundle of responses, guys. Our brain is pretty primitive, but it's pretty powerful. And a lot of what we do is unconscious. But here's the deal. We have a thought. So a thought. There's neurons. There's brain cells, which are neurons in the brain. You have a thought, and it lights up that neuron, and it sends a pulse down the neurotransmitter, this little leg off the neuron, off the brain cell. And then there's an empty space, and then it jumps that space into another little entrail, another little whatever that tail is, to another brain cell, to another neuron. So there's a connection that's been made between one neuron, one brain cell, and another. And it keeps firing along that path, so a little roadway. It keeps firing and firing every time you have that same thought. And so what happens is we start getting these really strong, they're wired in pathways in the brain. And this is where thoughts then become beliefs. Because what runs the show is not the thought, it's the feelings underneath the thought. And this is what I want you guys to really get a hold of. Thoughts do not run the show, it's your feelings under the thoughts. This is where this work, this empowerment coaching is so important because it gets underneath it. Okay, so the thoughts are a reflection of the feelings that we're feeling, and that creates our beliefs. So what we do in this work is we try to uproot that old, well-worn tire track, and we try to turn it in another direction. So this is where I say you can change your relationship to food, but it has to come with uprooting it, and it's not about the food. So rarely now do I ever give menu plans. Rarely now do I ever give diet plans or calorie counts, because usually when I assess the person, it's not about the food. Now, sometimes it is because the person is already empowered. She's already feeling good. Or if she's heading into show, I don't have time to be able to work with her in empowerment coaching. I got to get her into show. I got to get her down. And those women are really easy to coach because they're usually black and white, all or nothing, which is one of the archetypes we're going to look at in the next audio. Really important. So she has her strengths as a perfectionist, as a black and white, as a, you know, I'm going to do this 110%. But the fall down is it doesn't sustain. It doesn't sustain because none of the beliefs, which are based on feelings underneath, have been changed. And so the thought can't change. And so she does not have a good relationship with food. And it will come back. And this is where we see diets fail. Because what diets do is they focus on the food. They don't focus on changing the cognitive behavior of the person. They don't focus on being able to create new pathways in the brain. And this is what we're doing in my one-on-one coaching. This is what I'm giving you a little piece of in this audio. And this is what we're doing in the Empowered Living course. So here's the other interesting thing. The brain, besides having these neurotransmitters that fire and they set down train tracks in the brain, and then the habit gets ingrained. And so this is why you may, at 7 o'clock, always want to have something to nibble. Because it's a habit. And sometimes it's just habits, and you've just got to break that habit. But the strongest habits are the ones that have the underlying beliefs that are unconscious. I'm going to look at that in a minute. Number two, the negativity bias. This is so interesting. This is what psychologists and psychiatrists know for sure. And when you look at the field of cognitive behavior, our brain focuses on the negative over the positive. The negative has a stronger emotional charge than the positive. And the reason for that is because it is rooted in survival. We are survival beings. It is survival of the human species. So if we didn't draw our hand back from that stovetop element that's on, red hot, like my brother did when he was five. I still remember. Why did that image come to my brain? I don't know. There is an emotional undercurrent to that, actually. That was such a shock to me. So it's funny that that just came up like 50 years later. When we have the survival mechanism, we need to run away from that tiger. So we may see beautiful flowers in the field, but if there's a tiger lurking about, our brains are going to signal the survival, the negative first. Never mind the positive. Never mind trying to grow into a fit, healthy person, because we got the survival thing happening. And so the brain offers more attention and resources and emotional intensity onto the negative, not the positive, because it's trying to protect. It's a default setting in our brain. But when it does this and focuses on the negative over the positive, it locks out that stuff that's pointing you towards your highest good and your greatest potential. So, and they're also three times stronger. And so in order to disassemble or even to neutralize a negative belief or thought or habit, you've got to have three times the positive reinforcements in there. This is kind of how the brain works. So the negative prevails over the positive because the negative bias has a greater charge, because it has to have a charge, because it's there to protect you. It doesn't want you to die. It doesn't want you to be eaten by the tiger. So it's really interesting, because what we do in empowerment coaching is we disassemble thoughts and beliefs, and a lot of them are unconscious. It takes sometimes a little bit of time to get there. It's not therapy and it's not counseling. That's very, very different, and that's often focusing on the past, and it's about intellect. So tell me your story. What happened when you were a kid, right? And then you can cry about it and grieve about it, but there's not always a deep healing, because you're looking at it from an adult's point of view. It's been intellectualized. It's now a story, and now you're 40 or 50 or 60 years old, and you're telling a story when you were 5 or 10 or 15 years old, or even 20 years old, or even something, you know, from 5 years ago. The ones that are so deep are the ones that are unconscious, but they're also the ones that run the show, and this is what we know about beliefs, right? So it is necessary to neutralize, get to the root of what's causing you to sabotage, what's causing you to be a victim in your own life, what's causing you to be a perfectionist, why, where did this come from, where did this start? And then we find that pattern in there, and then it's kind of like we hold it up to the light, and it's like a chrysalid, and it shines in a different way. You see all sorts of colors in there, instead of just a round ball of glass, which just looked blah sitting on the couch. Now you've grabbed it and you've drawn it up into the light. And now it's reflecting all these different facets and all these different shimmers and colors. And you look at it in a different light, and it has a different meaning. And now it's beautiful. So that's what coaching can do, because it disassembles and reassembles in a different way, so that you come back to it and it's rearranged in your brain. And now the neurons don't fire that way. The neurons don't fire the old way. They're starting to fire a new way. You're creating a new relationship to your own thoughts and behaviors. You're able to create a new relationship to what lies before you. So shamanism, which is really cool. I'm a level 2 shaman. I know a lot of you guys don't know it, but I studied under Sharon Von Ralte, who's very well known. She's from Ottawa, and I was there for a year and a half and took a lot of courses with her over the weekends in the winter in Ottawa. And what we believe in is that you start to, when things happen to you, when trauma happens, and when I say trauma, it's not just the big stuff. You can have little traumas, like you're not happy in your job and you've been doing it for 10 years and you hate your boss. Those are 1,000 little traumas that is just things that are going against your own truth, your own voice, your own spirit, and that cuts in too, right? That's another loss, and it's another way that you subjugate, or you try to, you know, bury it, or you just put up with it against what you should be doing or where you want to be. And so the word trauma has, you know, a lot of context because we're in the Me Too movement, and therapy has been pretty big since the mid-70s, so trauma's become this big word. But when we use it, it just means all the little ills. Sometimes it's the thousand little ills, what I find, that are more challenging and more prominent than the big ones. I can talk about the big ones, and I can go into those, but it's a thousand other little ones floating around that I've endured over decades where I kind of get lost in it. And so those are the things also that we want to change. And so in shamanism, we're reclaiming lost parts of ourselves. And so I did a lot of shaman journeying where we go to what we call the underworld. I know it sounds terrible, but and you do it through drumming, and you do it through in a certain environment, and it's like a dreamlike state. And no, there were no drugs, no drugs allowed. And you go into the underworld, and it was amazing to me because I could see myself. And this was after my son was diagnosed. I can still visually see what I was seeing. It's so prominent. And I was dismembered, and I was lying on the ground on top of this mountain, and it was barren and dark and windy, and I was totally dismembered, and that's exactly how I felt around my son's diagnosis. Nothing worked. I couldn't get anything in my life to work, and it was like my body wouldn't work, and my clothes were tattered, and I was just laying there wondering, what the hell hit me? And so what we do is we scoop up. We when the parts are lost, there's a loss of vitality. There's a loss of connection, and a lot of people numb out. This is what we call numbing out, and this is what anxiety is. You numb out, and it's because there's lost pieces of yourself that you need to reclaim. And that's the beauty of shamanism, and I like shamanism because I'm an earth baby. I'm a Taurus, but I do love the Mother Earth, and I do love all of the pagan rituals that people do. It just makes sense to me to go back to Mother Earth and the simplicity and depth and beauty of it. And shamanism is about reclaiming those lost parts of yourself. So that's a negativity bias. So it really is all about we're wired to focus on the negative over the positive for survival reasons. And that is why we start building up. We start building up layer upon layer upon layer. It's not healthy for us, but it is supposedly to keep us safe. So when somebody says, oh, don't you think you're a smartass? Well, look at you with your new outfit and your hair or whatever. And your little girl is like 8 years old. Now, you may fight back, or you may just let it brush off, or it may be, oh, my gosh, who do I think I am? I shouldn't be that, you know. And this is where some girls start to dress down, or they don't want to wear makeup, or they don't want to stand out too much. They don't want to be attacked by other girls. I went through that when I was in high school. And then I went through it again in bodybuilding because I love the sport of bodybuilding. And I think I used it as a tool for rebellion against my father. I also like, you know, independent, more isolating kinds of sports because I don't like team sports because they scare me, you know, and there's definitely more work for me to do around that as well. But, you know, in my world, and I won't go into it in too much detail, but in my teens, it was some stuff that happened around the house, and my dad was always entertaining pretty prominent guests, and some of them were male guests, and nothing terrible happened to me, but enough happened, innuendos and conversations and little things that happened that scared me. It scared me because I felt very vulnerable. I felt unprotected. I thought anything could happen at any time. These were like big, strong men, and I was a little girl. And so I started protecting myself, and I started doing things to offset. And that meant downplaying my looks, downplaying my clothes, downplaying my body. And it was kind of a scary time because I lived in a big house. It was like 5,000 square feet. And my parents were in their own little world. They were rarely around. And a lot of the company had to go past my bedroom to go to the bathroom, which was at the other end of the house. And sometimes I had some knocking on the door. And like I say, nothing really happened, but enough happened or could have happened that scared the crap out of me, that I felt unsafe. I felt unprotected. I felt abandoned by my dad, who I always wanted to be there, or I would tell him about it, and him and my stepmom would laugh, and they would go, oh, come on, right? They dismissed it. So I learned to compensate, and I carry that with me in my 20s and 30s and 40s, right? I still have some of that today, but now I recognize it. Now I recognize it was a survival mechanism. It was a negative, and that's what I had to do. But it didn't work for me as I grew older. It became self-limiting. It became I didn't feel free enough in my physique. I didn't feel free enough to dance. I didn't feel free enough to go to certain parties because I was fearful of what might happen, although nothing ever happened. That fear was there, right? Fear. And to protect me, my psyche went, oh, this is bad. This is negative. You're in another negative. Remember back then? It could happen again. So this is what our bodies are wonderful protectors, but they're also wonderful limiters. They're limiters of freedom and joy and flexibility and ecstasy and walking into your own truth and living your own life. And then I just want to touch on beliefs here before I finish this off. So here's the interesting thing. See, we're wired for finding patterns in our world. Again, this is the wiring of the brain, and this is cognitive behavioral science here. So our brains are wired for creating stories, okay? Really, really important. With all my one-on-one clients, it's always dealing with their stories. I deal with my own stories, too, with my coach. It's about the stories, but we're also wired to prove ourselves right. Really important piece. So the default setting of our brain is to assume that all the patterns that we find in the world are real. So all men are assholes. just trying to think of some. People with money are not to be trusted. There's these patterns that we lay over our beliefs, and we always work to make them right. So we're going to find ourselves, put ourselves in situations to make those stories, those beliefs, right. So it's really important that we understand that we throw our beliefs, we throw our conditioning out ahead of us, and we move towards that so we can make it right, because we want to be right, because, again, that's another survival mechanism. I'm right. That tiger's in the wood. Good. That means I got to scoot out of here. What if you're sitting there going, well, I don't know if I'm right or if I'm wrong. I don't know if that tiger's really in there. I'm just going to, like, sit here and play with my toes, and we'll just see what happens. No, we make our stories right so there is certainty. But we get locked in with certainty, and we don't challenge them. And that's the big thing. So the confirmation bias is another thing we throw around. But basically what it means is once the beliefs are in place, our minds start to look for evidence that would support them and disregard evidence that wouldn't. So our unquestioned beliefs ultimately affect our perception about reality. So my beliefs, your beliefs, here's a good one for you. I always believed that, you know, you work hard and you get what you deserve. You work hard and you can succeed. Not necessarily so. When it came to bodybuilding, I worked harder than anybody. But I wasn't going to be an IFBB pro because I kept thinking the hardest girl wins. No, not always. There's genetic limitations for sure. As you age, it changes as well. So I had to rechannel that belief and say, it doesn't always, because I was setting myself up for failure, and I was working my body to the bone thinking, no, I just got to work harder, I got to work harder. No, you got to actually work smarter. Work differently, not harder. I always say that to my husband. He's like, oh, when we have a fight, I'll try harder. I'm like, no, don't try harder, try differently. And that really is more of a challenge than trying harder, right? So beliefs about identity. So this is really important. So our beliefs about our own identity are the most embedded ones. So an identity is a series of beliefs that we have about ourselves. And people act very consistently in alignment with the beliefs they have about themselves. Really, really important, right? So when people believe they're worthy of financial success, they attract financial success. When people have an underlying fear of money or a belief that I'm not worthy or I'll never get more than $30,000 or $40,000 a year, guess what? Right? They are making it true because their underlying belief is I'm not worthy. Or I see this with women in the gym, thinking I can't lose 30 pounds, or they'll lose it, but they won't sustain it. Why? Because their beliefs aren't in congruence with their results. And they go, holy shit, how did I get here? How did I get here? I can't sustain this. I'm not an athlete. My whole family is big. I've sabotaged this before. What's going on? And they sabotage again, and the weight comes back on. And I have seen this for decades. So what we have to do is change the underlying beliefs. And it's usually not beliefs around food, although that's a part of it, but it's a small part. It's beliefs around self. It's beliefs around self-esteem, self-awareness, self-worth. And that also, those beliefs we see in other areas. But I can have a woman that's making $250,000 a year, but she cannot get her body in line. And you would think, this is where people say, well, I'm empowered. I'm making good money. I got a good job. But it's about the belief systems and the feelings underneath. So that's why I'm able to coach women in any industry. It doesn't matter if it's banking or healthcare or parenting or how to fix car engines, because it's not about the industry. It's about the person, and we're all operating the same way, in a cognitive way, in a psychosomatic way, and in with our beliefs, thoughts, patterns, and conditioning. So this is where we're looking, we're bringing that, that glass ball up into the light and seeing things from a very different way. So beliefs about capability. Beliefs are what we are capable of or incapable of. And we need to help people see that their rules and standards can be unrealistic or they can be quite realistic. So beliefs are very, very powerful. And the difference with getting to the beliefs is what's underneath the beliefs are the feelings. There are thoughts to it. I'm not worthy. Okay, that's a thought. That's a sentence. That's a story. What does that feel like? What does it feel like? Where do you feel it? Oh, my God. I'll share this with you before I end this audio. Here is a belief. I'm not worthy. And so one time I remember when I was like 12 years old, I found out my dad had another wife and another kid in another house across town. A lot of you guys know my story. And he's like, oh, well, I guess I should get the two together so we can come to know each other and, let it all be forgiven. He just wanted everybody to forgive, right? It's like, yeah, okay, well, it might take me a bit of time. But anyways, he took me and my sister to this other woman's house. She had a baby with my dad as well. So suddenly there's my new stepbrother who's running around. He's 6 years old. I go through new stepbrother's bedroom, and there's all the same stuff, all the same toys, all the same gifts that my father gave me when he would return from trip was in this kid's bedroom on the shelves. I distinctly remember saying to myself, oh, I'm not special. I'm not special. All these years I thought I was the light of my father's eye, right? I was his little girl, and I was, but when you're 12 years old, or maybe I was 11, when you're walking through and you're seeing this, it's like my whole life was a lie. I had been living a lie. My father was not who I thought he was, and he was with some other kid spending his time with another half-brother I didn't even know about. It was a secret. None of us knew about it, and I remember looking at everything, and I felt it in the pit of my stomach. It was like somebody threw a rock down my throat, and it ended up in my solar plexus, and it went thump. And I had this heaviness like somebody punched me, and I went, oh, my God, I'm not special. And so that stayed with me. It resonated with me, and I carried that with me into relationship after relationship after relationship. So what I did, and here I can talk about it, intellectualize it, but I've done the work around this. I would go from relationship to relationship, but I would pick guys that were below me. To be perfectly blunt, because my dad was very powerful. He was very successful. And to me, to pick somebody like that was just risking another failure like I felt. And the men in my life, of course, resembled my father. We do. We pick our parents, guys, I hate to tell you. Okay? So there's something in your spouse that's either their mother, your mother, or your father, or a little bit of both, or whoever your main caregiver was. That's the way it goes because we're hooked into that pattern. And that's why you see a lot of women will marry, you know, maybe an alcoholic, and then the next one and the next one. And they'll always say, I didn't know he was. But it's because the energetic pattern was there. That's what you sensed, the level of comfort, and that comfort does not have to be healthy, the level of, you know, assertiveness or aggressiveness, how he talked, how he moved, whatever, resembled somebody in your life, and it had the same tendencies in his lifestyle, if that makes any sense. And that's been looked at many, many times, and I can certainly see it in my life. So I chose below me as a way to protect, because there you go again, that negative. The negative was way more powerful than the positive. The positive in me, right, when you look at the negativity bias in our brains that wire us to keep us safe, the positive would have been, I'm going to pick a better guy. I'm going to pick a hugely successful, empowered, loving, financially, you know, off the charts kind of guy. No, I didn't go for that. I chose the guy who was washing dishes at the local pub, or I chose the guy that was really nice guy, but he was unemployed, and I know one day he's going to get a job, right? Because that was my level of self-worth. Because I had experienced such a loss with my dad that I felt like I didn't know any better. I took it on as this is all I'm worth. This is all I'm worth. And I did not know how to voice that for 35 friggin' years. Isn't that crazy? So this is where we go into the feeling work. And I had to go back as a 12-year-old. And it's not painful. It's really eye-opening. Because I can tell my story. I have stories. You have stories. I have stories about my son's diagnosis. I have stories about my addiction and my near-death experience with drugs. I have stories about the emotional abuse and about, you know, finding out about my dad's family. Those are stories, but they resonate within. And then you have little stories along the way, too, that add up. Once you start to get to the framework, once you start to understand, I get it, but it means leading you a different way. It's not about story writing. It's not about letter writing. It's not about necessarily talking it out. It's about having something or somebody at the other end that's pulling that fabric apart in a different way. So you've woven your fabric together, your life story, into a fabric. And there it is, and it's all pretty, and it's all in one piece. And then what empowerment coaching does is it slowly pulls apart the strands and remakes it into a new pattern. It makes it into, it's like a quilt with all the different patches on it, right? It makes it into a different visual pattern, a different patch. And before you know it, you have a different story. It's the same story, but it's rewoven. And suddenly you have bright colors. And suddenly you have, there's freedom and there's insight and there's clarity and there's those aha moments. And then it's like, they just release. They release their hold on you. Because you start to see it from a different place. And we call that the 30,000 foot view. And when you do move up into that place of neutrality and you're not caught in the lower echelons of shame or guilt or apathy or grief or fear or anger, those are all places where they're all run by our stories. That's the stuck ones. That's the stuckness. Above that is courage, neutrality, willingness, acceptance, going up into joy and love. And those are the empowered states. So we have the disempowered states, and then we have the empowered states. Now, we can have feel-good moments, and those are great. I love the feel-good moments. But and you can be empowered, say, in your financial world, but not empowered in your personal life, in your marriage, in your community, in your family, extended family. Oh, we all know that one, right? A lot of times we'd rather just cut family out, and sometimes that's what we have to do, too. We can still love them, but it may be that if you're empowered and they're disempowered and they're dragging you down to that place, you need to cut the strings and work on self and allow yourself to live with more joy, more vitality, and you need to change that charge within you, right? So it's about neutralizing the charge and then changing the charge to empower you up into a higher place, to find that little gold Buddha inside of you, to find that place of vitality and joy and purpose and light and goodness, that spark, because it's always been there. And it's Don Miguel Ruiz who wrote The Four Agreements, and he also wrote a couple of other books. But one of the books looks at domestication. So it's kind of the same thing as the clay Buddha. Domestication is where you throw people's expectations and you do stuff from a domesticated place. So this is where we talk about the grandma that just wants her little grandson to eat his dinner because, you know, this is what grandmas do. And you're supposed to finish your plate. And he goes, well, I don't want to. And she goes, oh, come on, you got to grow up big and strong. And he says, well, I don't want to. I'm full. And she says, oh, come on, there's starving children in Africa. So suddenly the weapon then becomes shaming and guilting this little boy. And suddenly he downplays his own ability to read his own body that says it's full. And he subjugates his own will and his own his own intuition, and goes, okay, I got to make her happy. Okay, this is what I'm supposed to do. And so then he takes on the shame and the guilt of this little, you know, just this little conversation between him and his grandma, but he carries that with him, and he feels a little bit heavier, a little less dark, and certainly not lighter, because grandma wasn't teaching from an empowered place. And if she had just said, okay, I honor you, I know you know your body, then that's fine, because honestly, no kids ever starve themselves. But this is what we do, and we call this domestication, and we start living up to people's expectations, societal expectations. We do things to fit in. We do things for our survival. And this is often where, you know, we're out and about, we see somebody with a new pair of shoes, and you got a dirty pair of shoes, and you're thinking, oh, they're not going to like me as much if I go out with them and I have a dirty pair of shoes. I'm going to be thrown from the girl tribe or whatever, right? And so they have to go out to keep up. And I see this a lot in my work, keep up with the Joneses, keep up with the Joneses. But what it does is it starts wearing on them, or they can't say no to outings. They can't say no because they're, you know, on the surface it says, well, I don't want to miss out. But really what's below it is, well, you know, I was kind of a loner in school and I was left out of a lot of things and people ridiculed me, or whatever the stories happen to be. I had that story for sure. I was picked on a lot and I had to change schools, and then I had to go back to my old school again after 3 months, and they were mean to me. And so I, rather than fight back, I did fight back for a bit. But I fought back with drugs and alcohol. It wasn't a good weapon. And then I went into myself and got really dark and depressed and gained a ton of weight and didn't have any friends. And I caved in. I caved in to the mean people, the mean girls at school. And that is why I probably don't have a lot of female friends, because I still have that running inside of me, right? Girls, women, they're competitive. They can be mean. Right? I don't always trust them. And that is a little girl thing that I have recognized in my business. When it comes to working with women, I'm really good as a coach. But then if it moves into, oh, we'd like you to join this or join that or come out with this, I'm like, right? Because all of a sudden now it becomes personal. I'm like, okay, who am I in relation to these women? And I've got that little bit in my belly that goes, oh my gosh, I'm a little bit fearful of this. But I can usually then work my way through and go, okay, what's this attached to? Oh, right, I remember when I was a teen in school, I got it. Is that what's happening here? No, not at all. So the awakening, the, you know, coming to understand how this works, you can disarm it pretty fast. And then you can move into the joy and lightness of hanging out with other women. So that was just something I wanted to share with you. So I hope this audio made sense. This is part one of part two. So remembering who you are. So number one, how the brain works. We are a bundle of responses and reactions. And we set down well-worn tire tracks in the brain, and we sometimes don't even know that at 7 o'clock we reach for popcorn or whatever it happens to be, or somebody looks at us a certain way and we react a certain way. Those are responses that have been dug into your brain. We can change those. Number two, negativity bias. The brain will and the psyche focuses on the negative over the positive because it's about survival. So we have to override that. Number three, when we look at beliefs, we are always looking to make our beliefs right, and the unconscious beliefs are the ones that run the show, 80% of the show. And number four, thoughts and feelings. We need to learn the difference. We can't think our way out of feeling bad. We really can't think our way out of feeling bad. We can for a while, but it'll come back. It simmers there until we get to the root of it, and that's the feeling around it. What are those feelings? And this is where we go into the map of empowerment, and we start at the lowest level, the lowest resonating level, and this has been documented 20 years ago, how the body's emotional response and the energetics or the level of juice, the electricity from these different levels of consciousness, these different emotions. Shame is the lowest. We all have shame stories, guys. And it's one thing to have a shame story, like I have a shame story about my family, right, because we were ridiculed because of my dad's other life, but it doesn't resonate with me in the same way anymore. It doesn't run the show because I brought it to the surface and it's not mine to own. But still, every once in a while, it's like, oh, I remember you, Karen, from, oh, I remember that. And I was like, oh, but I don't live there anymore. It doesn't run the show. And we move all the way up through guilt and grief and fear, and anger is a big one for women. They don't want to touch that anger. Don't make me angry. I'm a good girl. I'm a good mother. I'm a good wife. Or if I'm angry, I'm going to be passive aggressive. You know, I'm going to slam the door and the husband's going to say, what's wrong? And you're going to go, nothing. Nothing's wrong. And nothing changes, right? And you just keep stuffing and stuffing and stuffing until it comes out in other ways. Because it always, anger is jet fuel that needs to be burned off. It is the most toxic of all emotions. Science has shown this, not just metaphysics, guys, but like real science, if you're science people. Anger has been shown to be very, very toxic. Probably I'd say anger and shame is the other one. I haven't really studied shame, but I do know that anger is very toxic, and it needs to be burned off, and that's where we go in and we release it and let it be free. Don't harbor it, right? Don't harbor it. So then we move up into the empowered feelings of courage and willingness to say, I need to do the work, willingness to say, I need to let this go, willingness to say, I'm not living the life that I want, I do have areas where I need to challenge, I do have areas I need to look at, willingness to say, I am so sad, I am so angry, I am so scared, and then have the willingness to say, I need support with this. How do I move into this and free it up so I can move into my greatest, grandest vision and version of myself? That's willingness. And I tell you, the people that I coach one-on-one are very willing for the majority. Always there's that client or two that's not, and I see them shuffle back to the safety of their cave. And it's a sad day for me because I know if they just stepped in and were just willing to be vulnerable, willing to feel, then they can move to the other side, because the other side is freedom. The other side is light, having lightness in the body. The other side is having a great marriage. The other side is not blaming or complaining, not waiting to be saved, not being a victim in your life, not sabotaging and going, why did I sabotage again, right? And then we can move up into joy and love and peace. Peace. Don't you want peace? Oh, my gosh. So I hope this was a little bit enlightening and empowering for November's lesson one of two. Remember who you are. I really want you to remember who you are, ladies, because you're not your role, you're not your money, you're not your clothes, you're not your challenges, you're not your stories. You're not. That's the stuff that we have to undress, and that stuff is it's actually pretty easy once you move into the process, and all you need is willingness and curiosity, those two things, and you will see miracles happen. Does it take time? Sure. You've been on this planet for, what, 40, 50, 60 years, right? And a lot of the resistance just comes from the psyche. It's going, I don't know if I want to let go of this. This is a little bit scary. But it's not. It's not. It's retraining the brain, really. And then it's living the joy that you deserve, living the joy and love and the light. All right, you guys, be well, and please enjoy part two. Ciao.
The moderator.